Charlie and I want on this first day of the program year to give you some hint as to one of the two theme books for the summer so that it does begin to become one of the contributing books to the continuing conversation, which is Holden Village. And secondly, I have three steps that I think are good first steps for lifestyle changes. But then the forum part starts in that any of the specifics, like how to heat your water and your house with a continual chimney fire, or that was the last one I heard, and it's a great idea, all of those will simply come from us sharing, not from me lecturing. So you're going to have a little bit of both. First is Charlie Mays. Just arrived today, and we put him to work immediately.
And to show you the depth of confidence John has, and he's got that arrow there, which he told me what that meant, and I forgot now. Essentially what it means is that he'd like me to spend just a few minutes talking about the Global 2000 report to the president, which will lead into some lifestyle questions. This is the first volume, which is the summary volume of a three-volume piece of work that the federal government put out. The second volume is a technical manual. It looks like the yellow pages in the Seattle telephone directory. It's probably 2 inches thick. And then there is the computer model, which is volume three, and it's a little bit thinner. But, yeah, those both are in the library. This is in the bookstore, and I brought some more up so that there will be plenty in the bookstore if you want to look it over. This is all most of us really need, unless we've got Lauren or somebody else's background in some of the specifics. I read that technical stuff and I'm sure it looks good. I've been giving it to some of my engineers in specific areas to ask them for their critiques so that I at least can say I've had it verified. On May the 23rd in 1977, President Jimmy Carter commissioned a study. And somebody in his staff or somebody came to the conclusion that, you know, what we have in the federal government, as we have in much of our society, is a lot of fragmentation. We have experts who study their issue, and they do that virtually without thinking about, well, how does this trend, how does this tendency affect what's happening in other areas? In other words, if we are down in the area that I live in, paving the Renton-Kent-Auburn Valley, which is very fertile farmland, we're taking land out of production. Well, urbanologists and others worry about that, and they don't worry about that so much in the Department of Agriculture. So anyway, this commission was an attempt to coordinate, or this study was an attempt to coordinate the work that the federal government was already doing. The projections were already there. Just a sidelight for those of us who are homers, the study director is an ALC layperson, and so that adds maybe a little bit of interest. I would like to share just a couple of things from this book. The theme for the year is Living the Politics of Hope, and if you pick up this book and read the front pages, the blue pages, which are the major findings and conclusions, you begin to ask, where is the hope? And so essentially what they're saying is that if present trends continue, the world in the year 2000 will be more crowded, more polluted, less stable ecologically, and more vulnerable to disruption than the world we live in now. That's rather sobering. Serious stresses involving population, resources, and environment are clearly visible ahead. Despite greater material output, the world's people will be poorer in many ways than they are today. For hundreds of millions of the desperately poor, the outlook for food and other necessities of life will be no better. For many, it will be worse. Barring revolutionary advances in technology, life for most people on Earth will be more precarious in 2000 than it is now, unless the nations of the world act decisively to alter current trends. This study goes through what we're doing to our, you know, the forest lands of the world. And every year we lose enough forest lands to cover half of the state of California, every year. arable land is lost to cover the state of Maine a year. Most of the deforestation happens in the third world. And we think we're not related to that. I like to tell this little story. And they point out in this study that in the Sahel in Africa, there are places where it requires 360 people or person days a year just to collect the firewood needed to cook their meals and to keep warm. It means one person in the family gets 5 days off a year from collecting firewood. As they take the firewood off of, as they take the wood off of the land, that means that it no longer holds the moisture as well as it once did. That means crops are harder to grow. As they deforest the land farther away from their population centers, then they end up burning vegetable matter and cow dung, which they formerly had put into the ground. So they literally are starving themselves to death. And we don't feel much relationship to that. I give this little sermon to my daughter, who's going to graduate in a couple weeks, who drives a lot. She's really graduated into driving a lot. And so I give her this little sermon about the fact that, that one of the things, as fossil fuels have become more expensive, we have driven more and more people to use firewood. It is the primary fuel for heating and cooking in the world. As fossil fuels become more expensive, more people are pushed into that. And of course, we who live in an affluent economy are able to go out and purchase fossil fuels regardless of price. So we have a, you know, we have a part in that whole web of things. The only other thing that that I wish to say, and this leads then perhaps into to what John says, the thing that I came really to see, and I think lifestyle change involves first of all beginning to see our world differently, but things that we never think about. Water, for instance. There are 200 major river basins in the world, and 148 of those are shared by two countries. The other 52 are shared by 3 to 10 countries. And we in Washington State know how badly California lusts after the Columbia River. And we're in the same country. So those are very destabilizing kinds of things. Let me just quote from as they move to the end of the study, and then I'll turn it over to John. It says, "Finally, it must be emphasized that if public policy continues generally unchanged, the world will be different as a result of lost opportunities. The adverse effects of many of the trends discussed in this study will not be fully evident until 2000 or later. Yet the actions that are necessary to change the trends cannot be postponed without foreclosing important options." And I think lifestyle change is part of what we are called to do to begin to alter present trends.
If Global 2000, and that's in a long series of similar studies, Club of Rome, Limits to Growth, Mankind at the Turning Point, The Ecologist magazine had Blueprint for Survival in 1972. The Global 2000 report is simply the official federal government of the United States with official agencies saying the things that people had been saying. If those things are true, then one of the things that's going to be affected is our lifestyle. I guess the time when I was most clearly convinced, yes, that really is true, is not when I heard some hippies talking about simplified lifestyle, but when I heard Robert O. Anderson, chairman of Atlantic Richfield Oil Company, at the Sheridan Park Hotel in Washington, D.C., at a Pachamit Terrace conference in 1975, conclude that the peasant classes of the world were better prepared for the next few decades than we, because we were going to have phenomenal changes in our lifestyles, whereas they had never lived without a modicum of fear, and they weren't going to be as affected as much as we. That there was a hinge year in the late 1960s and that we were on a gradual slope down, that the economic system of Lord Keynes, which had been very helpful in a time of great growth, was an economic system that had passed its prime and we would have to look for another system, and I don't know what his salary was from a corporate oil company at that time, And he ended, "It is a virtual certainty that we're moving from an age of affluence to one of greater austerity." And then the final words were, "Voluntarily or involuntarily, we are all going to see changes in our lives." I happen to think that that's true. Also happen to think that the United States had a conversation about that a lot more several years ago than it has right now. Not that the problems have gone away, but it's simply, we simply sometimes go into things in a faddish way. For a while it was kind of faddish to talk about simplified lifestyles, and that doesn't seem to be the climate now. I would like to prime the pump of the forum with three, first steps of go to natural fibers instead of polyester or some concrete things. That'll be fine for the rest. I'd like to have three more general principles. First one, Charlie's already stated. For me, the first step is a faith step. To me, the first step is a step of my vision, of my consciousness, of how I see. John V. Taylor, is it? Which one, Mary? John V. Taylor, I think. She doesn't know either. We had one on the Holden staff, and the other one wrote a book. The Anglican bishop, who wrote a book called Enough is Enough, has a sentence, "It really isn't our way of grabbing, it's our way of looking." I believe that that's the primary contribution that the church can make, is give us a new consciousness about our lifestyle. The real revolution comes at the level of our values and our perceptions. As long as we believe bigger is better, we will feel deprived if we have less. The real revolution is to believe small is beautiful. That's why E.F. Schumacher picked that as a title of a book. When you believe small is beautiful, it doesn't feel like deprivation to scale down. It doesn't feel like a defeat not to have everything bigger and bigger. You have a different set of values. I really think that's the most revolutionary thing, and that's a point at which the church has its primary interest, and that is in people's faith, in people's understanding, in people's perceptions of things. How do we do that? How do we get a new way of seeing? That can be part of the forum tonight, but don't think that you aren't on concretes when you're in the matter of the realm of faith, morals, and values. And don't think that unless we come up with something that changes the whole world, it's not worth doing. Another thing that I think is very important about a new vision is that the step itself has integrity for us, whether it brings this massive revolution or will be bought by every other person in your neighborhood or not. Move forward with those things that have value in themselves. I remember reading the journal of John Woolman, and he went to buy a ticket on a stagecoach. I think he had to go 37 miles. He was an old man by then, 70 years old or something. The next person behind him in line was black, and they wouldn't sell the black man a ticket. So John Woolman turned his ticket in, and he walked. It took him a couple days there. He didn't change the policy of a stagecoach company. If he hadn't written a journal, we'd never know it. The point was, there are too few who do it just because it's the right thing to do. And part of the reason, I think, of having a lifestyle change is that it has integrity in it. The story of the Roman Catholic priest who walked in protest on an issue in which he felt strongly. He put a cardboard sign and nailed it to a broomstick and walked down the street. And some people saw this old priest and laughed and said, "Father, do you think you're going to change the world with your sign?" He said, "I have no intention whatsoever of changing the world. I march once in a while to make sure the world doesn't change me." Not a bad start for lifestyle change that does not have to have proof of being effective for everybody before you do it. Secondly, if there is a general assumption that small is beautiful, scaling down, calling into question bigger is better, calling into question a convenience-oriented life, calling into question the fruits of materialism at some point, you probably will be counter-culture to a lot of prevailing values. As I look around the room, probably not all of you would feel it at, I think, the strongest point you'd feel it in the United States, and that is a family trying to change, and they have three teenage kids. You try it at that point when conformity is one of the highest values you have, so no kid at school laughs and calls you different. Probably if you begin to make some changes of any kind, you're going to be counterculture. That's one of the reasons that I think if you're going to start some changes, find a group of people who have a similar interest and do those changes together. Very simple. If I'm going to be kooky, I want five other kooks or I'll also be paranoid. And I simply probably don't have the kind of inner prophetic spirit to be the only one trying something different. So if at all possible, my hope would always be the local Christian congregation to which I belong, because we have a shared faith. We have a shared Word of God. We have a shared Lord. Start and see if some of those people aren't also interested in trying some things corporately. Secondly, there are more resources if there are 4 or 5 or 10 of you, and you probably will come up with somebody who has some expertise in some area that you don't have. In other words, there are more possibilities when there's a group of people trying to be imaginative and creative about some lifestyle changes, so you have more strength if there are a few of you doing it together. Let me give you just a couple stories of how that works. We were with a group of people in Washington, D.C., in a group called the Community of Christ, an inner city ecumenical community, 9 different denominations represented. And it was a group of people who were willing to try some things and talk some things over and do them corporately. And I still remember one of the nights when we started some alternatives, and I was glad we had a group of people to do it with. We had a social event that night. Many of our parties were also with the members we worshiped with. I think that's great when that can happen. I don't know how many of you can party with the people that you go to the Lord's Supper with, the Lord's table with, but it's great when you can. There was a young married couple that was there, and the man stood up and said, "Can I have your attention for a minute?" Which meant, will you all shut up long enough to listen to one conversation? Because it was a good party. It meant there were a lot of people talking and there was a lot going on. He said, "You know, we just got married recently. Today, my wife wanted to go and buy a waffle iron, and I said, not until after tonight." So then he said, "I want to know how many here have a waffle iron." Well, there were probably 6 hands that went up. All the married couples did. A couple of the single people did. He said, "Now I want to know how many times you use your waffle iron a year." The most was 6 and the least was once. So he went to the one whose hand was up, and they had the once a year. He said, "Could we borrow your waffle iron 3 times a year?" And they said, "Of course." And he looked just absolutely elated. He said to his wife, "I told you we didn't have to buy a waffle iron." He said, "I believe unless we are waffle freaks, we don't all need waffle irons." And everybody said, yeah, sure. And they went on with the party. About a month later, somebody reminded us of the night we laughed at Dunstan and his waffle iron. And they said, "I thought of that today. I went to rent an aluminum extension ladder. Awful price for one 24-hour or 48-hour period of an aluminum extension ladder. So I thought, I'll buy one." And then I thought, "But how often do I need one?" Well, I paint up there once every 7 years, and once in a while I clean the leaves out of the gutter, but I really don't need a aluminum extension ladder. Then I thought of our Community of Christ. There are 8 families within 4 blocks of me. Heckingers have a 20-foot extension aluminum ladder, $32. That's $4 a piece. We'll have our ladder hanging in anybody's garage when you need it. You're never more than four blocks away from our aluminum extension ladder. Sold. Just like that. Everybody, nobody said, "Sounds hippie" or "communist plot" or made a lot of sense. Okay. From those 2 spontaneous, not very dramatic things came all kinds of attempts of living corporately in a very urban setting. 3 families, 1 set of washer-dryer, 1 washer-dryer. And now that may be where you draw the line. All right, it's all right. You don't want somebody else's dirty underwear in your washer-dryer. Then don't do it. They enjoyed getting together and having a cup of coffee while it discoed through the spin cycle or something. So it made sense for them. Food co-op. Didn't take an awful lot of organization to do that. They bought the kinds of food they wanted that sometimes the supermarket didn't have. Large quantities of some things, cheeses and that. Saved a little money. One person had one long shopping trip a month to restock the food co-op, but it worked. Shared babysitting, lots of you had that. Just before we left D.C., they had tried the experiment. Three families, one car. That's tough. For lots of reasons, right? The maintenance of an aluminum extension ladder is minimal. The maintenance of a car, there's a great variety of how people, Mary can tell you, I'm touchy about loaning my car out. I can imagine three families, one car, and my saying to you, I think you ride our clutch. That'd be a lot harder for me to do. Let me give you a little bit of background. Little bit of background that if you've never lived on an eastern urban, in an eastern urban town, you may not know about. First of all, is the cost of insurance of a car. When we left D.C., it's been how many years, Mary? Seven? Eight? It was something like $700 a year for liability in the inner city. And I don't know what that would be now. What's the last 8 years in inflation? Very, very expensive to get car insurance when you live in the middle of a city. Let me add also, none of the three families needed their car daily to get to work. Most of us are caught in a situation where we could not function daily. They needed the car for the occasional trip to the suburb or the weekend recreation, not the grocery store, not the daily work. Thirdly, parking. Unless you've lived in the middle of New York or Washington, someplace, or saw The Odd Couple when Oscar won a car, you have no idea what it's like to own a car in the middle of the city. When I first moved into Washington, D.C., within the first week, I walked around to meet everybody, including the police captain. I still cringe to think how arrogant or presumptuous. I introduced myself as Pastor Schramm, new in the area, if there's anything I can do to help. He answered immediately. He said, if you can solve my parking problem, I don't care what denomination you are, I don't care if you're a preacher or not, I'll be eternally grateful. Then he told me that his policeman wrote 10,000 tickets a month in his precinct alone, and if he added to the policeman, they could triple the number of parking tickets. When he talked parking, all the color drained from his face. We found out what that meant, to live in that neighborhood and try to park a car. We lived where the people from the suburbs came in very early to try to find a place on the streets. Then somebody from our neighborhood who had to leave a place to go to work and come home at about 5 o'clock had to drive around and around until someone else left. I mean, 15 minutes, half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour, just around and around. You've worked all day and you've come home. It was so bad. We had a neighbor who one night came home, and I realized what he had just done. He left the car in the middle of 21st Street, not far from the White House, the middle of a main north-south artery. Went up on the porch, put his feet up, got a martini, and when the police came, he said, take it, take it. Nothing could be more freer than fewer cars. So for them, three families, one car was a great step forward. All I'm saying is, it worked for them to try something as an alternative and to try it communally. I've heard from them since, it's now four families, two cars. That worked better than three, one. Okay, all I'm saying is, we tried some things corporately, and if you have any possibility to do that, do it. Finally, start with those things that appeal to you as steps that would be freeing for you. Why start with those lifestyle changes that strike you as the most depriving? Why start with that which, oh my gosh, that'd be the end of the world? Start with the ones where you do really feel that the present lifestyle is not fulfilling, it's not good for your health. Start with those alternatives that strike you as being better alternatives than what you're now living. And I think all of us could find some of those. We had at the end of Newport Place, which was a one block street right in front of our house in D.C. I could give you a very quick history of how the streets in D.C. were laid out architecturally. M-N-O-P-S, all of those were white people, and all of those are three stories or four story high townhouses. In between, every time, Newport, Phelps, Riggs, Swan, all of those were black people who worked for the people who lived on the lettered streets. They could walk out of their kitchen and into the kitchen of the people they worked for. So there are always one or two story houses. So Washington, D.C. was aimed at a system of segregation. And a neighborhood that had both had two schools until 1954. Double schools in every one of those neighborhoods. Well, Newport Place, you got it. Black, little houses. There was a retired man, David Roberts, who stood in front of the Newport Market every day. Retired, nobody elected him, nobody paid him, he just presided over the street. If you come from a little town, it's those same people that sit in front of the post office or the store on a bench all day long. Know what I mean? When Time Magazine came through sending their reporters to ask, is the civil rights movement making progress? And they came to Newport Place, there was no question who you'd interview. It looked like he was in charge. So David made Time Magazine. We were all delighted. One of our Newport Place people made Time. The question was, do you think the civil rights movement is making progress? And David answered, I know it is. So the reporter said, well, here's somebody who knows. He said, how do you know, sir? He said, I just went to the doctor. He told me I have hypertension. That used to be only a white man's disease. What's he saying? That not every part of our affluent, convenient lifestyle, with all the progress it has brought, not every part of that has been good for us. This lifestyle also has the highest rate of thrombosis, neurosis, tension-related diseases, and a lot of other things, so that it comes to how you see. Somebody could come and say, I can't believe the advancements we've made in dental technology. On the other hand, somebody else could say, I can't believe a society that has as many cavities. What do they eat? Part of the advancements we've had have also brought some things that are not freeing. Start with those things and step out of them. You know the author, Simon, who writes Value Clarification? One of the first moves he made is a very simple one. He decided how many shirts were enough. Most of us haven't even done that. He came up with four. Maybe you'd say, that's not enough. All right. His point was, there is a point at which you do not have enough in the way of clothing to be clean and to have a change of clothes for tomorrow, so you need enough. There's a point at which too much is just a big bother. You add closets, you add storage space, you spend too much time figuring out what color is nice that morning, and when you move, you wish you didn't have all the darn shirts. So come up with that which is enough, and you'll probably move into a phase of more freedom than when you continue to accumulate more and more and more. Start with those things that appeal to you as better stewardship, more fun, giving you time to do the things you really want to do. Get rid of those things which appear to you now as be enslaving. Okay. The overall thing that I did not give you tonight, I want to conclude with and then get into the concrete parts. We're taking exactly half of the forum time, giving them. All that I've said has as the basic premise behind it that we have the luxury of choosing whether we want to simplify our lifestyles or not. The fact is, almost everybody in this room, if I know you, and unless there's a big surprise here, all of us do have that luxury. I want the forum to be in the context that all of us realize most of the people on the globe do not have that luxury. Most of the people live simply because they have no other choice. So let's, first of all, give some kind of acknowledgement that we have been blessed to where we choose whether or not we want to cut down. But the fact is, we really do live in maybe one of the several places in the world where we have the option and where most of the world does not have the option. I guess what I'm saying is, in the context of a Christian forum on lifestyle changes, part of the new vision is that one of the reasons I'm concerned about lifestyle is I want to live simply that others may simply live, that it's in the context of global justice also. So when we talk about first steps, it isn't though as though we see only our convenience or only our pleasure. It's, if Global 2000 report is correct, that we in this country and in some other developed countries of the world are using a disproportionate amount of the world's resources to live with the kind of throwaway society that we have. Okay. That lays out some premises. One of the ways we could start is, what kind of lifestyle changes have you made and want to share what that did or didn't do for you? Or what kind of lifestyle changes would appeal to you as living out a new vision or as freedom steps? And we'll just have some give and take on things you've done or read or heard or questioned on the basis of what we've said. Is that enough to get you stirred up?
I find it very interesting that as we get more specialized in things, we get too specialized in things, and we stray away from, for instance, in farming, and they, you know, use these big machines to till the crop and stuff. And they brag so much how these big machines replace the workers, you know, so many, and so we displace all the people of the jobs. And in relation, also when we do that, we're going away from what we're producing for ourselves. We're out of touch with our earth. And I see that as something that could really be, I guess I'm not, for personally, it's not so effective. I mean, I'm not a farmer, you know, I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. But I see it, if they could find a way to stray away from, you know, getting machines and stuff.
That is a very lively debate throughout the world in agriculture, even though you are not a farmer. I gave some things on the book Enough is Enough in Arapaho, Nebraska, and I didn't have any idea what I was going to do. What I did was open up that which they had been talking about on the picnics and in the parking lot and in the social life of that community, but they had never had permission to bring it into the church for an afternoon forum. The interesting thing was the two sides were some very young farmers and their grandfathers, interested in organic, large-scale organic farming without chemicals and draft horses, and in between the fathers who had the big machinery. As soon as I had about a half an hour, I stepped back and it just took off. I didn't have to do anything else because they had been given permission to have this discussion, and they had never put it in the context of some biblical understanding of care of the earth. It was a great afternoon. So the yield per acre, the long-term sustainable, Leo Bustead, who comes here every summer, always has the statistics, and they get worse every year, of the number of bushels of topsoil we lose for every bushel of corn we raise because we've cut out too many hedgerows, cut out too many windbreaks. So you've raised an issue that's very much part of the present conversation in the world about, and the reason I like E.F. Schumacher is it's intermediate or appropriate technology. I think it's romanticism to say we ought to get rid of all technology and go back to a crooked stick. But there are some things that where the technology is so big that the machinery is so heavy that you can produce more from some land going back to draft horses than you can that heavy machinery. And sometimes the fuel to produce it is taking more energy than the nutrition or the energy we're getting for our bodies from it. So at some point, that which was appropriate has gotten too big. Good illustration is the first one. Yes. There's a couple.
I was going to say a good example of that is the high productivity in the Amish farms, both in Pennsylvania and Iowa, where they do use some combination. Like they'll use a baler, but they'll pull it with horses.
Mm-hmm. Let me go over here and then out. Yes.
Yeah.
Give me your name, because I ought to learn them today anyway.
Jeff Townsend.
Jeff. Okay, Jeff.
A couple of things. One thing to watch for is that the ALC is coming out with a statement on the theology of land,
yes,
which has been in preparation for the past year, and is something to look forward to after the September conference. The second thing is that when all of you pick up that Global 2000 summary, like you say, it's kind of depressing to see all these things, but the important thing that you said is that these things are projections and not predictions.
Correct.
And as such, what these projections are is you know, they make the assumption that it's a static society and that lifestyles can't change and that policies can't change in government. But they just took it as status quo, took it from there and said by the year 2000, these catastrophes, really, will take place. So the ray of hope is that they are just projections and that we can make a difference between now and then.
And the full intent of the book is an encouragement for us to make the changes that need to be made.
I'm disappointed that they didn't go that step further and say, make some suggestions or make some long-range goals, which our federal government has been very lacking.
I think the other reality of the Global 2000 report is that it's a political document. And Carter made, to my knowledge, one reference to it during the... It came out in July of 1978. I mean, 1980, I mean. 80. During the... So it was 3 years of preparation. But it came out during the campaign, and he made one remark about the fact that we would have to learn, probably all of us, to live with less. And that's the last time he made that remark. And if you remember the debates, Ronnie just absolutely wiped him out on that, because we weren't ready to hear it. And even the Democratic economic policy is based on continued growth. And so... you know, I think we have a real vision problem in the church to talk about the kinds of things that John is talking about, that we're really a growth-oriented society.
There were a couple hands, I think. Did you have yours up, Al, before? Yeah, go ahead, and then Barb.
Any change, social, political, religious, or otherwise, that's going to happen in this world has to be began with one person, with me as an individual. And each of us has to change. If I stand around and wait for the rest of the world to change and then I'm going to conform to the world, this is never going to happen. If there's going to be a better world, a world ecologically, socially, politically, religiously, anyway, the change has to be within me. This is where everything starts. It's within the individual person. If I'm not going to change, the rest of the world is going to change either. And the second thing is, I'm glad that we finally arrived at the point in our civilization where we're no longer trying to build the rest of the world up to our standard, but we now see that we're going to have to build ourselves down to the standards of the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a real sharp cleavage. We're on the edge of a revolution and we don't see it, mm-hmm. really. This revolution we're in is bigger than the Industrial Revolution was, or any other social revolution has ever been, where there's going to be a sharp demarcation between the haves and the have-nots, where the common average person is going to have far less than he's ever had before, and the people above that level are going to have a lot more than they're having today.
Thank you. Barbara?
My question is, I guess I don't understand enough about economics or politics to... I'm wondering, does it just follow that if people in America start making these kinds of changes, will it follow? How do you think that relates to the global situation? Will it just, I don't see that it will just follow that because we're using less, other countries will have more?
Well, I
think it's more involved than that.
Yeah. First of all, we import more food than we export. It comes in the form of coffee and bananas and pineapples, etc., etc. We import more than we export. That's really a shock, I think, when people realize that, you know, when we start to talk in those kinds of produce, you know, that we are essentially in that kind of situation. So
but
that
we have, like, what's the percentage? Almost half or more of the world's resources, don't we?
No, we consume.
We use or consume.
But most of it is consumed.
Yeah, but I'm talking about food products because we always and food and fiber products because we've always fancied ourselves, at least I always did, that we were the breadbasket of the world. But because of the kinds of crops we import, you know, we take away the productive land that could be used in Haiti, for example, to feed the people, is used for coffee and other kinds of cash products for us. So that in itself would be one, I think, major kind of shift that, and so because people always use the argument, well, the problem is distribution, and there is a case for the problem being distribution, but a change in this country would change the distribution system simply because of that net.
If we actually cut down on some coffee.
If we cut out coffee, which until I got so I couldn't sleep if I drank afternoon, I alone kept the quota high. Now I drink decaf. No, but you know, so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of those kind of things. I think I'd like to throw in one other thing. I think I went through a project for a study thing I went through in my parish, and we probably didn't give it all the commitment we should and all that. But I'd like to throw out two challenges for the time you're here, and this is something John and I have talked about because it's really out of his. Kind of concerns that I've developed mine, basically. Most of the examples that are given are urban and rural. And so we thought, why no suburban examples of simplified lifestyle? And you can play with why that's true. And I think it is true. The other thing that I'd like us to throw around is I don't think we're going to change very much. I think we're going to be changed, and I think that's the good news. For the whole world. And I think it's going to be hard as hell for us and for our kids. But I think that's the good news for the world. And I think that's really hard for us to say. That, you know, I think there have to be some people around who are lifting up the models that when the change comes, it isn't bad. That we can survive. But biblically, I see the hope is that God will change us. So I'd like to contest, you know, if the change starts with us, and it has to start there, I suppose, I'm not a very good self-changer. I change only when I have to. And part of the change has to be a vision. But anyway, you know, I just like to throw those two things out as something to discuss.
I've been thinking, everybody's been sort of dancing around it a little bit, but when you get right down to it, the things that are going to change America's lifestyle, they are going to be economic considerations. And that's what you have just pointed out, and what the ultimate disaster of the Global 2000 report is, that we're going to have to change eventually. Those things that are going to change us eventually are economic considerations, when we can no longer import those things that we don't really need, et cetera, et cetera. So if we can see some new visions, these new freedom steps that we're going to do in our personal life, how much better if we can come up with an idea that in addition is going to be economically advantageous and therefore, as an example, be a popular method to have copied. I guess in the recent past with petroleum prices being so high, solar heating methods, et cetera, are an example of where people began to consider those things on a broad scale. Consumers Reports does evaluations of it because it becomes of economic interest. And if we can make changes that will be economically advantageous, so much the better. The examples will be great if we can come up with a few things that are economically straightforward, I think we'll really have an audience.
OK. can you think of them besides solar? I agree with you on solar. And one of the things about tonight, a forum does not answer everything, but if you get some ideas sparked and some places to go down the path with a few of the ideas. Bolin is his last name. He's a solar engineer for the electric utility company in Portland. The interesting thing in Portland is it is to their financial interest for you to go with a combination of electric and solar. So they are pushing a passive solar house with electrical appliances and are paying him, and he and his family had built their own solar house and they found them and he has been up here. He has a great tape that I think makes a good case for no matter what kind of heat you choose after you've built your house, you can cut the cost and the amount of heat you need by 50% by simply building the house in relation to the sun, not in relation to facing the front door to the cul-de-sac so you're not embarrassed when people come to your house. With the right trees, with the right insulation, we could cut, and not cut aesthetics at all, we could cut the amount of energy we were using by starting by building a passive solar construction, not an active solar system. So there's lots of things that are going on that are alternatives that do make sense, that can be a kind of demonstration that other people will emulate. Yeah, but can you name some
of them? To give them one example of why I think we have to be in a political arena, in the recent Seattle Times article, there was a thing about the deregulation of the appliance industry relative to energy efficiency. And it's interesting to me that the Carrier company is screaming loudest about deregulation, because it's cheaper to build less efficient units. And the reason they're screaming is that who buys 50% of their units? Builders who have no interest in how expensive it's going to be to maintain them. So it's, you know, that's a different, I mean, I think that's kind of a sign of hope. But anyway, that's
true. One of the things that we can do as a community and as human beings is to conserve certain things like water when you're showering. Turn off the shower when you're soaking, you know, things like that. If we continue to do that, we're going to continue to save water. I mean, that's just one of the many things that we can do.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many others, too, that we take advantage of as a society.
And that is economically a good thing to do. You decrease your water bill. Riding your bike to work. All the billions of Chinese don't own a car. None of them do. They're all using either mass transit or bicycling to work if they're on their own schedule. And that can certainly be economically advantageous and healthy, which is also economically
advantageous.
Yeah, I think the economics is the key factor for me anyway. Something I've been involved with in the last few months is a group of unemployed people in Northern California, and there's coalitions all over the state that are working on the plant closures. All the big plants that are closing down and moving either to Asia, Latin America, or to other parts of the United States where you can get cheaper labor. And one of the things that we've come up with through this whole process, we're looking at alternative ways to run a plant like that, having the workers buy the plant and run it themselves. The other thing that was real interesting, all of a sudden people started discovering this is the only developed nation in the world that does not have any kind of legislation that prevents companies from just picking up and moving out when they want to. And that's significant for me because I think we also need to start to, instead of always seeing ourselves as the exploiters and feel guilty, to see that we're being exploited too. And I think when we act out of our own, you know, seeing ourselves in solidarity with the people that are more oppressed, but seeing our own connection to that and feeling what that does to us personally also, then that's more of a motivation.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Mary?
I mean, this all makes sense to me, and I agree with, you know, if there's anything I've heard, but I feel real frustrated because I have a real sense of powerlessness when you're dealing with supply side economics. You're dealing with power and money is power in this culture. And how to fight that whole system that has created a need beyond our ability, you know, beyond our needs. I don't see how. I mean, I want to believe that it will happen if we and others who join together begin to use less. But I mean, I know so many who don't give a damn, and they're not going to change. And I sit there in my parish and I look out, and it's a community of academic people, you know, from two colleges. And they are living simpler lifestyles. They are doing without. But there's a whole another mass that isn't even touched by that.
Mark?
Well, I was just going to say, I can think of one instance where it's already happened in a big scale, and that's the manufacture of small cars. How many American manufacturers made a small car that people were interested in? None of them did until the gas crunch got so bad that the Japanese market, they had to compete with that, and so now, you know, there must be dozens of.
But they're also small cars that cost $4,000 or $5,000 more. Well, I still wouldn't buy an American car yet.
Well, but it's a first step.
Yeah.
In picture when economically they were forced to do something. And I think that's where the changes are going to come, where we put the pressure on.
But the name of the game is still corporate profit. And as long as there are businesses that need to make profits, and if they no longer make profits, they're going to move to something else, or we're going to be, I mean, our whole economic system in America is built on profit.
I think you're right, and I think one of the tensions that exists in the truth with the Global 2000 report and the reality of the fact that America is a very corporate country and our economic structure is based on the decisions of a few hundred large corporations, which primarily think in 2, 3, 5 year profit plans and managing their portfolios so that they don't lose money for their shareholders. And yet there is a good precedent in this country in the history of our economic relations where our government has stepped into the free enterprise system and has said, we can see, some of us can see a little further down the road, and we can see that certain technologies might be to our benefit if we would invest a lot of money in research and development of a new idea. And a couple of things that come to mind are synthetic rubbers. During World War II, a ton of money was pumped into synthetic rubber research and then development. And that, of course, made a big difference in the war. Since the war, the development of microchip processing and a lot of stuff related to microchips was funded in the late 60s and early 60s by the government. A tremendous amount of money was given in those lines. And that spurred some thought in corporate decision-making and development planning for production in the future. And since then, that actually turned out to be some really beneficial stuff. And I think with a combination of those things, there is some hope. You were pointing to the fact that, you know, they do work in 2, 3, 4 year profit plans. And I think there is some hope, but I'm not one of those that has much of a faith in all that. I just think it is an interesting thing to point out. I guess I say that because I think we could pump a heck of a lot more money into solar development and the electronic process or whatever the process is that has to reduce the size and the efficiency of the chip to make it economical, as opposed to spending billions of dollars on a thing like the B-1 that is a turkey, was a turkey, and always will be a turkey by John Glenn. I mean, it seems to me that those are just commonsensical things that can make a difference, that we can influence just politically. I don't think that necessarily has everything to do with our faith perspective, and I think that's something we could bring up too. But I guess I do see glimmers of hope. I have my doubts, but I can see glimmers.
I think I've ignored Nancy a couple times, and if I've ignored somebody else, speak up. But I know you have your head, had your hand up. Sorry.
Well, beginning with the individual, feeling comfortable. I think we have to start with feeling comfortable and good about yourself and how you're meeting your needs as compared to the world's needs. And then the corporation idea, I think, really can work well because our minds are, I want it for ourselves, I want to be there now, I want to get this, I want to have this, I want to get in my car and be at a certain place at a certain time. I want it now. That's our problem. We keep saying, I want it now. And if you look around at your neighbors and do say, how many of you have gone into a supermarket and noticed your neighbor just on the few doors down this shopping at the same time? You probably could have cooperated and shared cars at that time. I found I'm in a situation where I live 50 miles from a main city, and there are like five or six of us that attend church in this locale. And it was easy enough to arrange for doctor appointments at the same time or sharing rides because 50 miles of sagebrush gets really monotonous after time and time again, so it got to be more enjoyable to find excuses to share rides, and then finding a bus system that also, if you needed to stay and extend your stay in the city, ride it back. I know, again, that's a rural example, but it was all of a sudden out of necessity and desire to share with a neighbor, and it helped. Just to be a support system in that sense.
Bob? Well, we haven't talked at all about education, and of course the youth of this country needs to have something more solid to start thinking about, even from kindergarten and before. Somewhere along the line we've got to change our public school system and everything that goes into it.
You, but you've just quit.
I know. That's why I got out, but I couldn't change it.
Mary Schramm.
So, this is just another aspect, but it's... I feel very deeply about lifestyle changes, but I'm very angry with myself because the more lifestyle changes I make, the more judgmental I find myself being. And especially with my family, I find it very hard with family and friends to share the joy they have over a new gadget or car. I just don't know what to say anymore. I get angry that I feel like simpler than Bow Mary or something like that. I don't know if people have ways that they deal with this original sin. I just the more lifestyle changes I make, the more judgmental I start to feel about other people, and I really don't know how to share their joy about when they say, isn't this a great thing, and I just look at them. That is so dumb.
Yes.
I very much share what you're saying, Mary, about this sense that somehow our change in lifestyle, if not shared by others, is not accomplishing the goal that it might be, and therefore there's this feeling that others aren't pulling their weight. If I can simplify my lifestyle, then all the rest of you ought to be able to, too. But I think that's also part of the enormous complexity in which we live. To take your synthetic rubber example, what is synthetic rubber made from?
Oil.
And what did the U.S. switch to synthetic rubber do to the entire economy of the peasants of Malaysia? It was based on rubber production. The third world is developing, is rapidly moving to industrialization, and greater percentages of the people are becoming dependent upon industries in which we participate as final consumers. One of our member here, we used to kid back in Albuquerque, I won't mention any names.
He's not present here tonight, though.
No, he isn't here tonight. Anyway, we used to kid him about having taken a pledge never to buy anything made in Korea. For some very good principles, and yet look at the complexity of that decision. Look at what that does not to corporate interests in Korea, which can hardly be affected, but the vast numbers of people who have lived on the land and now have moved into industries which are based on U.S. consumption. The island of Java, until recently, has been virtually self-supporting in food. Java is the size of Illinois. Java has been supporting with food 70 to 75 million people. Now that is changing rapidly. As Java begins to industrialize, Java no longer can support itself with food.
Java becomes an importer. And I think that in a way, though, we will look for and take joy in steps of simplifying our lifestyle. We have to see at the same time that that isn't the basis of any hope for the future. That any steps that we take to change are not necessarily steps which are going to bring in the shalom. That the shalom is still going to be dependent on God somehow working through us despite ourselves. And I have trouble with that.
You have trouble with...
Well, I have trouble because I was raised an optimist, and I was raised hoping that through technology and through cooperation and through our democracy and through our political system, we could somehow improve the lot of the world.
Okay, all right.
Yeah. And I see now that I have a strong feeling that no matter what we do, that really isn't going to be the case. That we may be improving our own, we may be changing our own vision, we may be participating in some new shalom, but our efforts are not, our efforts at simplifying our lifestyle are not going to mean constructive changes for all the people of the world. In fact, they're going to mean hurt and harm and pain and suffering to a lot of other people, that we are wrapped up in the guilt and in the sin of the world regardless of what we do.
Okay. Al next.
Yeah, on this matter of economics, one of the first things you have to consider is there's been a big change in money standards. Money has become global. It is no longer American economy, European economy, the economy in Java, Asia, or anywhere. It's become a global thing. Money has no flag, no country, no people, and no concern for what happens to you as an individual or as a nation. It no longer cares. And when we talk about changing things, we're only going to change to meet the standards that this global international money is going to dictate to us. And we're going to make it easier for ourselves to accept it, that we're going to have lower standards of living, housing, and all the rest of the things that goes with it. But we need not look for any comfort anywhere from international global money. And this is what's running the world. They have more money invested in communist Czechoslovakia, Poland, Russia. They have money invested in Argentina, all over. They don't care about all these issues that we are concerned with. And they're not going to solve them for us, and we're not going to do much about solving them either.
I forget your name. You were
Kathy.
Introduced.
Pardon?
Kathy.
I think it's kind of ironic how a lot of people, in trying to simplify their lifestyle, usually go toward the healthful aspect first. And it seems like it's just a transfer of consumer dollars in a lot of ways. Like, you cut back on consumption of alcohol, say, but you go to the spa and use, you know, pay out more dollars to use you know, equipment that's made, you know, which is made by increased production, or going to organic health food store to pay higher money for organic food. It's like sometimes it's just a transfer of dollars rather than an actual cutback.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, and simplifying. I think a lot of people are trying to simplify, but not realizing that they're just transferring their
The summary of whether or not there really is a simple life movement in the United States is a great question. Stanford Research Institute thinks there really is a simple life movement, that there are now 5 million people who have changed their lifestyle significantly, and that by 1985 that'll be 35 million. And they think that the business community is picking it up and that they're starting to make less junk, and they're really retooling for a very different America. Mother Earth News in Coevolution Quarterly says that thing is off in a magnitude of 100. If there are 50,000 people who have really changed their lifestyle, that'll be great. The rest is a superficial fad of redistribution, of now eating different kinds of food and paying more for it. They had a cartoon at the top of their article that showed the local Porsche dealer had changed his name to Briar Patch Porsche and had put Live Simply in every windshield. Somewhere in between Mother Earth News and Stanford Research Institute is the truth, somewhere in there, I guess. I think we've now gone 1 hour and 5 minutes, so I'm going to take a break so that you all who want to leave, usually we take a break and then you want to stay a little longer, that's okay too. We've got lots of things that came out, and the conversation can go on. That's what's nice about Holden. Seems to me a couple things have become clear. No one is saying that by us changing a few things in our lifestyle, we will solve the world's problems. That was not our premise. It is a complicated, it is on levels of politics, it's on levels of international economics, it's on levels of technology, it's on levels where you can't just talk about problem solving, because when you take a step, you accentuate a different problem. Club of Rome called it a milieu or a problematique, that our solution creates a new problem, and that we are moving into an age where we feel it down here, because the confidence is kind of gone. All right, I think that's true. One thing, though, Mary, I think that is a premise tonight is that one of the first steps for us to take does include our own lifestyle. That even if the situation is complicated, the place I still have the most power to make the first step is in my own lifestyle. And there is an integrity to that. There is a possible accumulation of other people taking those steps. One of the things, if it gives you any hope at all, it's within my lifetime. Now, I'm on the older scale of this group, I know that. It's in my lifetime that the really critical things, that all of them that we're talking about, has come. When I was born, there were 2 billion people alive on this earth, and there is now 4.3 billion. More than twice the number of brothers and sisters share this globe in my lifetime. And the last year that the experts told us that we had a lifestyle that could be shared with everybody on the globe, that we did have a sustainable society in the level of consumption and energy use in the United States, was 1952. Any of you who were alive then, it didn't feel like we were in just absolute deprivation. The real exaggerated consumption and waste is very recent. It's in the last 30 some years. So that when you talk about reversing something, that accumulation could be reversed if we tried. Another thing that I think is really important is most of us will be consistent. In other words, I will not do something inconsistent with my own lifestyle and values. So that if my vision is such, then I'll work for the larger issues that need to be worked on, or I'll have a more global perspective. But it seems to me one of the things we're saying is too often we keep in the realm of theory or get bogged down in the problem and don't take the first steps that we really can take. And I think some of them are not only healthy but are helpful but are good for our health. I'm going to tell one story and then quit. One of the things that this brings us to in the United States will be very new for us. One of the things that the culture of the United States has done is to make old always mean obsolete. So we never look to the elders of our tribe for any advice. It's simply, most tribes have, but not the United States. One of the best retreats I ever had, I'd like to share with you. We took some people from a senior center. I still have not found a name I like, but that's what they called it. Everybody knows what that means. It meant that the youngest person on the retreat was 77. We took them, and I have my stereotypes of older people. We took them out and I debated, but we had a session right after lunch. That's not a good time for me, and I certainly thought it wouldn't be a good time for them, but we tried. We ate at 12 and at 1:30 we had a session. And I went through the summary of the Club of Rome, did some things from John B. Taylor's book on Enough is Enough. Not only were they awake, they were alert. I mean alert. And I thought, well, what's going on? But I enjoyed having a group of people that were interested. After I quit, at the end of an hour, I found out why. The first person said, do you know, and I wasn't the only one on the retreat, there was a group that it's fine. Do you know you are the first people who had the assumption that we still want to think? Well, I did have that assumption, but I didn't know it was the only group that had ever had that assumption in their senior center programs. Little lady, she was at least 85, in the corner said, "Yes, you didn't pull up with a bus and show me another damn lake." The point that they brought out during this retreat is we have faced lifestyle changes twice. One was called a depression, and the second was called our retirement. We did pretty well both times, and no one has ever asked us for any advice or help. Some of the possibilities for the future, we have some people among us who have lived a lifestyle that's an alternative to the present lifestyle, and they did pretty well. We tend to only think of them as stingy or tighter than the bark of the tree or depression mentality or lots of other stereotypes. Some of them were very resourceful and creative. So I not only find some hope, and you gave a good entrance into dealing with the word hope. What we're going to find this summer is the difference between optimism and problem-solving mentality and a biblical understanding of hope. It seems to me that maybe the present situation is going to drive us back to what the writers of the scriptures referred to as hope. Maybe we have not, when we thought we were on top of everything with our technology, maybe we haven't experienced hope. So it's not a bad start to the forum if it said that the theme for the summer is pregnant with possibilities. That was a poetic way to end. Any of you that want to go, or the staff, that there is an open house going on and you're missing it, anybody that wants to stay will visit a little bit more. But thank you for your attention. Oh, for you that are still here, tomorrow night's topic, Derek has come recently, 1978, recently from South Africa, has been a student at Wartburg Seminary, just graduated, will share with us. I think we in the United States do not have a good sense of what's going on in South Africa, and Derek will give some input, and then we'll get a chance to discuss that tomorrow night, same time, 8:15. We'll announce that again tomorrow, but I was going to share that tonight. Anybody have something else that you were frustrated because you couldn't say it, or you have a question?
Yeah.
All right. What did you want to say, Gertrude?
Well, I can't figure out why big industry talks about conserving oil. You know, I mean, we have it in gas and when we were rationing it. Nothing ever gets said about the tremendous amount that's used in plastic. And I just think we're just so overwhelmed with plastic. When I go at Christmas time and go into the store and see toys that are nothing but plastic stacked from floor to ceiling, I just think, why isn't ever anything said about that waste? It's junk and it's non-degradable, you know, and pretty soon you just see all the yards full of this stuff. And yet we holler about the gas and that kind of energy, and we never say, you didn't have plastics when I was with my kids. You know, and I can't figure out, we got along without it. And I would just wish even the bags would go so high I never could buy one. Because I'm guilty. I use them too, and I use plastic wrap, and I use Tupperware. And I get mad at myself.
Yep.
Just like Mary, but I don't understand why why we don't get at that angle of, let's get rid of the plastic or make it so it's not so easily available.
I don't know if the cost of oil will take those up to where the cost is prohibitive. I tend to think not, because the wooden toys and the other things are still vastly more expensive than the plastic. So I think the one thing that Stanford Research Institute study showed was that when people change their lifestyle, they tend to move away from synthetics to natural fibers. They revolt against throwaway appliances that cannot be repaired, encased in plastic and that kind of thing. They tend to move away from jobs that only talk about the number of dollars that you earn, and they move toward that which gives them more sense of satisfaction or vocation. They have about five or six criteria. One of the things was that we would move away from that kind of throwaway society, but I don't see it happening.
Well, Lauren, I think it's beginning some in the playgrounds. Now we're seeing a little bit more wood, and people making their own.
Part of it is still it's an economic. It's more the wood products are more capital intensive, I mean labor intensive, and therefore more expensive. But also the plastics are not, I mean, they're a byproduct of the whole petrochemical business, aren't they? I mean, they're not, I mean, so it isn't only that...
You mean it's a waste product, really? That
well, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not enough of a chemist to know exactly how that breaks down, but, I mean, they'd have to do something with that stuff anyway, right?
Right. As I understand it, I don't think that the plastics themselves are as... They are becoming a problem because we are so overexposed to it. I guess personally, the thing that bothers me is in the science field is the fact that we totally don't know where our energy capabilities are going to end. I mean, if there was some way I could say, I know we get exactly this much energy, you know, that we're going to deal with, we don't know that. And so we keep on, in terms of development and use of things and alternatives, they're good, they're great, they're important. But I guess that's the thing that bothers me most. I don't have that answer, but there is a definite increase in the use of plastics for various reasons. You know, they're easy to handle.
Right.
You know, you can see through it. You know what you're buying at the store. You see, but that doesn't necessarily make it right to use. And,
And then we have still more waste from it.
Yeah. I guess I feel that when you look at work, you know, from the physical standpoint, and energy, which is the whatever, I guess I ultimately don't know what energy is, but it's the ability to do work, and we measure it in BTUs and horsepower, but we find various ways, fossil fuels, more efficient nuclear power. Look how efficient that is, you see. It's mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say one more thing. And then you get to the situation, well, we really haven't even tapped our fossil fuel resources. You know, I mean, I don't know that either, but...
What do you mean, Lauren?
Well, in terms of, we were concerned in 73 with the oil crisis.
Yeah.
Okay? And was that really a crisis? Ecologically, or was it a crisis imposed by other economic factors? You know.
Well, Rudy Edmonds, who will follow you as the geologist, he worked for Mobil Oil for 20 years or something before he started teaching. He has been saying for years that there is 30 or 40 years of oil. So if you're talking about is there a crisis, meaning it's a non-renewable resource that the world is running out of, it seems to me that that's fairly well pointed out. What Club of Rome did was to say, let's say they find five times as much oil as we think there is, the real shock was that added only 10 years to it. So if we're off in a magnitude five times of the reserves, if we hadn't cut down the consumption of oil, our exponential growth in the use of oil would mean, okay, it's 50 years instead of 40, but we were still getting to a society that was so dependent upon the fossil fuel that we were moving toward that kind of crunch of some kind. E.F. Schumacher used to try to image that so we would know, and he said, last year we spilled more than we shipped in 1930 or 40, just to give us some sense of the growth in the use of oil in every aspect of life, what we wore and what we ate and the fertilizers, and so it's not only the gases. Yeah. So, crisis, only if we don't either find some alternatives to that or modify that tremendous growth in the use of oil. So, I don't know what crisis means, but I don't think they've changed that, have they, as to the known quantities?
No, I guess what I was saying was that there's so much, so many other factors involved. If you look at the projections, okay, projections say that we are limited in our fossil fuels, but the technology, the use of nuclear power, for example,
yeah.
what, I'm just trying to think in terms of percentage of energy that it produces today versus 10 years from now. We are, as a world, just naturally going to use more nuclear energy, which will cut down the use of the fossil fuels. Do you see what I'm saying?
If
you look at the United States and the ability to produce nuclear power plants in the world, this, again, the projection, but it's escalation of another alternative energy source. And that's why I said I don't really know if we knew where that point was, where the energy limit was. We don't. And as far as I know, what I've read and studied is things that we haven't reached that understanding yet.
And the problem we get into, I think, coming from where we do in the church, from really a laity standpoint, with both in terms of those scientific questions and the economic questions. I got into this once with a fellow who was married to a person in my parish in Virginia, and he's an environmental economist.
Yeah.
And he says, read history. Every time you've run out of a resource, you develop another resource. Mm-hmm. It's an economic problem. So that's where I think we come back on the vision thing. And the thing that I think is that's tragic about our generation, my children and grandchildren are the only children and grandchildren perhaps, or their generation, who ever had to fear their parents and their grandparents. Because we came into a world that was pretty safe in terms of the toxins that were abroad that had been at least man-produced. And we're leaving a pretty toxic world, I think. And that's one of the things that, like, in terms of nuclear power, I think this is part of the image thing, do we have the right to continue a kind of a lifestyle that depends so heavily on energy that it will mortgage our children and our grandchildren's future? We just hope, like everything, that they'll be able, you know, whether it's through the glassification process they're now developing over in Hanford or something, that they'll find some way to contain that radioactive toxins. That's, I don't know. I mean, I'm really really been digging around in that. And then there's the question of the conversion in energy and producing heat. You know, what I know about the law of thermodynamics, what's happening to the heat we're producing in those exchanges?
Go ahead, we've interrupted you.
I'd like to visit with you.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I see as a real danger in this kind of discussion, small but real danger, is that we can go back to our congregations and become proponents for change to a simpler lifestyle, and some very, very thoughtful and provocative and progressive things we can do. Or we can go back to our congregation and pretty much badmouth technology, badmouth this, badmouth that, and be very negative people. When the fact of the matter is that, for instance, just as plastic is an example, we aren't going to do away with the automobile probably entirely, and plastics have decreased has increased the fuel efficiency of the automobile. other things, alloys in bicycles have made bicycles more reasonable for people who are not interested in getting hot and sweaty on their way to work to ride their bicycle, etc. Technology can indeed provide the answers to make the simpler life more attractive to everybody in general. And I think that we run a real danger in turning our back on science and turning our back on technology and saying that is evil. This kind of progress is evil. We shouldn't be putting any more money into industry. What we should be doing is trying to direct industry in those directions, because there indeed is the psychic energy that are going to make real impacts into these problems. And the second thing, I guess, that I think is a real danger is that everybody passes it around every once in a while, that what I guess it was expressed a little bit back here, that if we do something we cause another problem. Well, that's probably true, but that's true in every field that we have any endeavor in, and we can either remain sitting here tearing our guts out wondering if we should do anything, or you launch forward and do it and let the chips fall where they may. And I think that's one thing that we can come out of this conference in doing, is to make some decisions of what we want to do and try it.